This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Former Vice President Joe Biden is on the hunt for someone to fill the post he held for 8 years under President Barack Obama. Biden already established that he will pick a woman as vice presidential nominee on the Democratic side of the 2020 presidential election. But which woman? And does it even matter? The so-called Veep stakes grips national political media for days, and then the announcement comes, and outside of the one nationally televised debate between vice presidential candidates, does this election carry much weight? The new book, Do Running Mates Matter?, poses that question, but uses empirical data to reach its conclusions. The book was written by Christopher J. Devine and Kyle C. Kopko. And Christopher Devine, who is also an assistant professor of political science at the University of Dayton, joins us now on the phone to talk about it. Christopher, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Very excited to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here. And for those of you listening, if you have questions about the consequential or inconsequential selection of a vice presidential candidate, or you just want to join the conversation in any respect, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can email your questions or your thoughts to talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Christopher, before we dive into this deep research that you and Kyle conducted to produce this book, Do Running Mates Matter? I'm generally curious about what you learned about the office of the vice president, because I think about how long I've been alive. Only once has the vice president ascended to the presidency. That was by election in 1988. George H.W. Bush. Just tell us in general about what you learned as a political scientist about the office while you were conducting this research as it relates to campaigning for it.
Sure. So, you know, we study the electoral effects, not as much the service in the office, but there are other scholars who have done tremendous research on this. Joel Goldstein is a law professor at St. Louis University, and he has what I would consider the definitive book on this. If anyone's interested, it's called The White House Vice Presidency. And what he established, and this, you know, goes together with some of what other researchers have found, is clearly vice presidents have become not just more important over time, but truly important. And we can look even to Joe Biden's vice presidency, for example. So, you know, just for a short history here, if you look at the Constitution, there's very little that a vice president has to do. They ascend to the office if something happens to the president, temporarily or long term. They preside over the Senate, or at least they're supposed to. They usually don't. But they're there to break a tie vote in the Senate. And that has happened a number of times with Mike Pence, for instance. But those things, you know, they're not terribly consequential. They can be, if there's a succession, it is. But that's, as you say, rare. Since the 1970s, though, this really started with Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale. Carter really empowered Mondale as the vice president. Essentially allowed him to become someone who not just had an office in the White House, and even could sit in on any high-level meeting, would have access to briefings, intelligence reports, and so on, would have weekly lunch with the president. Not just that, but was really a trusted advisor on any issue that would come up. They weren't tied to some piece of bureaucratic turf, like a Treasury Secretary, let's say, or Defense Secretary or something like that. They were just there to help the president be successful. And that's what we've seen in recent years. Again, refer to the Biden vice presidency. When President Obama had to negotiate with Congress in the budget negotiations in 2011, who led that? Joe Biden. He was a key liaison to the Congress, also on gun control. When it comes to diplomacy, foreign affairs, often it's the vice president who is not going out there, you know, leading their own policy. They're voicing the president's agenda, but they are a key liaison to foreign leaders as well. So vice presidents are very consequential, although informally. Their formal powers are very limited. But their informal powers granted by presidents for the last 4 years are very significant.
Well, the reason I wanted to ask that question first was to establish that, yes, of course, the office of the vice president is consequential in many ways. It is a very important situation for someone to find themselves in, because obviously you do naturally ascend to the presidency should something terrible happen. And the analysis that you and Kyle Kopko conducted to produce this book, Do Running Mates Matter?, sort of concludes, though, that there's not as much weight given to the second person on the presidential ticket in election years than maybe we would assume.
Right. Yeah, the electoral influence of the vice presidential candidate tends to be overstated, and often badly overstated. You know, I've even seen analyses this election cycle saying the election will hinge on who Biden picks. It's important, you know, partly for the reasons we were just discussing, that if this person gets elected, could be a real asset to the administration. for 4 or 8 years going forward, or it could be a real liability. That's one thing. But in terms of the election itself, I think very few people vote based on whether they like the vice president, vice presidential candidate. In fact, I would put it this way. When we talk about a running mate deciding the election, what we're kind of hypothesizing, if someone were to do this, is that someone was going to stay home or was going to vote for, let's say, Donald Trump in this case. And then Joe Biden picks someone. They say, I would love to see that person be the vice president of the United States. I will now switch from staying home to voting for Joe Biden, or I'll switch from voting for Donald Trump to voting for Joe Biden. I'm very skeptical that that happens much. However, where they are consequential, and this is the big conclusion from our book, it may seem common sense to some people, but no one's ever established this with data. That's what we do in the book. It's really the first book on the electoral effects of vice presidential candidates. What we establish is that the choice of a running mate reflects upon the presidential candidate. In other words, people are still voting for their favorite presidential candidate. It's just that their perception of who that person is, in this case, let's say what Joe Biden's priorities are, political priorities, his ideology, his judgment, and so on, that is significantly influenced by his choice of a running mate. If he picks someone who does not clearly have the experience to step in and be president of the United States if necessary at any time, people will look at him and question his judgment. If he picks someone who is from perhaps a different wing of the party ideologically, or let's say a less favored wing of the party, they might judge him less favorably for that. Or if it's from a wing of the party ideologically that they like, they might judge him more favorably from that. But they're always voting on Joe Biden versus Donald Trump.
And that's because this is really the first major decision that a presidential candidate makes as far as who will occupy the White House and the main seat of government along with them. And that's that happens usually in the summer months leading up to the traditional conventions. We might even know by now in a regular election year that's not impacted by a global pandemic. But because Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee and Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, we're dealing with two men who've been in the public eye for a long time. So people have a pretty good idea about who they are and what they stand for. But they also happen to be much older than the traditional candidate would be for this office. Either of them would be sworn in as the oldest president ever inaugurated. What role could that play this year? Because obviously, as we've established, the vice president ascends to the presidency should something terrible happen. Is there more at stake this year for either of them? Does the data that you collected support that people would give that some more thought than they might in other years? These guys are old.
Yeah, so we do have a pretty good analog from recent history here with John McCain's choice in 2008, which I'm sure will come up a lot. It does in most discussions of this. His choice of Sarah Palin. John McCain, of course, he was significantly younger than Joe Biden is now, but his age was an issue in that campaign, and he was running against someone whose age was also an issue for the opposite reason, that Barack Obama, some people considered him too young, not enough, didn't have enough experience, and so on, at least to the point where it was a concern. I mean, they were strong enough to get the nomination. I'd say that with Joe Biden, too. I don't think people widely expect Joe Biden to somehow not make it through his first term. We'll see if he runs for a second. A lot of people don't think he will. Okay, fine, whatever. But there's enough confidence in that he got the nomination, right? But there is more concern than there normally would be, and with good reason. And for that matter, Joe Biden had health issues in the past and aneurysm 30 years ago. He doesn't have a clean bill of health entirely. So it's reasonable to have some concern. And just to want to know for sure, as you start to think about who you're going to vote for, to know for sure who would be backing this guy up if something happened to him. If he makes a reckless decision, that increases those concerns. And in fact, we show this statistically. 2008, in the book, there was actually just, we're using surveys that already exist. We didn't come up with these questions. So fortunately, in 2008, there was a good set of questions available for checking this out. So surveys asked people, is John McCain too old to be president? And they also asked, is Barack Obama too young to be president? And what we found in the book was that people who thought, for example, Sarah Palin was not ready to be vice president of the United States or president potentially, they were more likely to express concerns about John McCain's age. And in turn, they were less likely to vote for McCain. Vice versa for Barack Obama. After he picked Joe Biden, people who believe that Biden was ready to be president were less likely to think that Obama was too young to be president. And in turn, they were more likely to vote for Obama. So, you know, across a range of perceptions, you know, are they too old or too young in this case for Joe Biden, too old? You know, what's their ideology? What's the quality of their judgment and so on? What we show, you know, really repeatedly in recent years is that all of those perceptions of the presidential candidate who people are actually voting for, just to be blunt about it, those are shaped by their choice for running mate because, Michael, as you were referencing there, this is often considered the first presidential act. It's the first concrete statement of this is what my administration will look like. And for that matter, a foreshadowing of, you know, what kind of choices will be made for a variety of other things. When Barack Obama picked Joe Biden as his running mate in 2008, it wasn't just that he said he'd surround himself with one experienced politician, especially in foreign affairs in that case. But I think a lot of people inferred from that. They took it as a signal that Obama would then go on to choose well-qualified, experienced people for any range of other positions, such as, you know, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and so on.
And again, we're talking with Christopher J. Devine. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Dayton, and along with Kyle C. Kopko, an associate professor of political science and associate dean and director of the legal studies major at Elizabeth Town College, he co-wrote, Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. And you note that there are many considerations that go into a presidential candidate's selection of a running mate. But as you also point out, you use data here. This isn't a book about punditry. This isn't a book about speculation. And those are fun to read. Those are fun to talk to. But this is a very serious book that you would expect to come from someone with your educational background. So the book tests for, according to the release, direct effects or whether evaluations of the running mate influence vote choice among voters in general. You review what are called targeted effects, or if running mates win votes among key subsets of voters who share their gender, religion, ideology, or geographic identity. And you also examine indirect effects, whether running mates shape perceptions of the presidential candidate who selected them, which in turn can influence vote choice. And that's sort of what we were talking about there with Barack Obama's selection of Joe Biden. But I found it interesting going back every 4 years as your book examines the various races over the past 50 or so years, that there were ideas in mind, and they range from geographic balance. They range from ideological balance. They range from novelty. And ultimately, it concludes, though, that the guy on top of the ticket is still the main guy. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the research that you conducted and how you went about doing this and presenting the book that you did.
Sure. So, yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. You know, we are in some ways, as I like to often describe it, conducting an intervention with the political punditry world, what's often described as the parlor game that is deep stakes speculation. It's fun. I mean, I enjoy it. I'm sure you enjoy it. It's fun. OK, but it can be really irresponsible. And a lot of it in the sense that this is a consequential choice. Right. I mean, you wouldn't want a presidential candidate choosing someone because of some hunch about how it might affect the election. You want someone to make a really good governing choice, you know? And there's a limited amount of evidence we can go on, though. If a presidential candidate and, you know, the staff were inclined to look at the available evidence, we hope they would be kind of evidence-based in a lot of things they do, you know, where would they go to? There's kind of a limited amount of research that's out there about this. And as I said, never a book that really ties all this together. It's about, you know, not just one election, but a series of elections. It's not just about one type of potential electoral effect, but a range of electoral effects. You know, gender and running mates has never been studied as in-depth as what we do here and so on. So what we try to do is get our hands on as much mostly survey evidence, good representative surveys that have been conducted basically over the last, you know, 50, 60 years. More of that that's specific to a running mate we can only get from, say, 2000 on, especially like 2008, as it happens just by coincidence. By far the best range of survey evidence available is from 2008. So, you know, just to give you one example, Michael, you know, I think my favorite part of the analysis, we're able to get our hands on panel data. So panel data, and, you know, speaks specifically to 2008, 2016. Panel data involves going back to the same people over time throughout, in this case, a campaign, okay? Not moving from a different sample of voters one day to a different sample of voters the next day and so on, but going back to the same people at different points in time and tracking potential changes, or maybe not changes, maybe stability, in their opinions or their behaviors over time. And just to give you one example, when we wanted to find out, okay, Sarah Palin, 2008, among other effects, did she bring women into the Republican coalition? That was partly the perception of the McCain campaign. Picking a woman as a running mate would increase vote share among women. Okay, if that were the case, what we'd expect is if we had survey respondents from June. She was chosen August 29th in Dayton, Ohio, by the way. She was announced. She was chosen August 29th. We can get panel data where someone first entered the pool, basically, in June, and then they're asked again July, August, September, October, November, the same set of questions, including how are you going to vote? How are you planning to vote? Okay. And so we can statistically account for essentially how they were already planning to vote in June before Palin was picked. I'm talking about women specifically here, and then see, you know, controlling for that predisposition that they had to vote Republican or Democrat. How did women change over the course of the campaign? You'd expect, if the conventional wisdom is true, we could apply this to 2020, by the way, in terms of Biden picking a woman as his running mate, we would expect that women became that much more likely to vote for the Republican ticket after Palin was selected. We see no such effect. And this would shock a lot of people. Frankly, it surprised me, at least somewhat. In 2016, we find no evidence, using the same kind of method, no evidence that evangelicals or conservatives or Midwesterners, any of those three, that those groups significantly moved in the direction of the Republican ticket from before to after Mike Pence's pick as Donald Trump's running mate, after he was picked. In other words, when we control statistically for how people were already planning to vote in June, in that case, we see no significant change in their intended vote at any point, at the end of the campaign. Didn't essentially move any votes. And same for, by the way, Catholics, for Tim Kaine and so on. So most of the things you hear about how a running mate is going to change how a certain group of voters in home state, by the way, is a whole another thing I can get into. We see very, very, very little effect there, essentially. Well, very little. Most of those things that you hear about don't end up panning out, but people just kind of assume that they did. And they don't go to the evidence to see. And so we go into the next election thinking that some effect will happen again that, by the way, didn't really happen the last time.
And that's exactly why I wanted you to explain the way that you gathered the data, because as you just said, we could turn on any of the cable networks right now and see a panel discussion about who Joe Biden might choose and why, what the pros and cons are, and it will be the exact same type of criteria that are analyzed as they are every single election cycle. Again, geographical balance, gender balance now. And it just seems that you've presented a case that there is evidence that none of that matters as much. I also found it interesting, you know, looking at the 2008 race, that neither major candidate, Barack Obama or John McCain, ended up going with their first choice. And a lot of that was weighed by those criteria that may not in fact matter. It turned out, and this was something that I may have missed when it was reported previously, you note a book by David Axelrod, the top campaign strategist for Obama, writes about how Obama wanted Tim Kaine, who ended up being the selection for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And of course, McCain had wanted, it seemed like, just about anybody who was from the traditional mainstream Republican Party, or even Joe Lieberman at one point, before being convinced that Sarah Palin was really the strategic play to make. I just thought that was so curious that you found data that suggests it doesn't matter, and they both went with candidates who were not their first choice.
Absolutely. You inspired me. I actually have my book next to me. I don't know if I can do this on air, but a quick quote from Barack Obama, what he said about Tim Kaine. The problem with Tim is that we're too much alike. I don't know how many young, liberal, Harvard-educated civil rights lawyers with very little Washington experience the market will bear. That's a quote from Axelrod. Now, Obama, the evidence isn't as strong about him, you know, really strongly preferring Kaine and being held back from it in the way that we see with John McCain in 2008. This is part of the mystery for many people. How did we end up with Sarah Palin? Some of our listeners may know, if they don't, John McCain fully intended to pick Joe Lieberman as his running mate in 2000. Of course, Lieberman was the senator from Connecticut, formerly a Democrat, lost his primary in 2006 and got elected as an independent. But he had been the Democratic running mate for Al Gore in 2000. So this was a really bold pick. Now, why would McCain consider Lieberman? Because they agreed on foreign policy, particularly the Iraq War. That's about it as far as Joe Lieberman fitting into the Republican Party. On social issues and economic issues, he was, you know, pretty much your standard Democrat. So when McCain and his team, including folks like Lindsey Graham, somewhat clumsily in Graham's case, kind of floated the idea of maybe him selecting Joe Lieberman, they got a lot of pushback from the party, which goes to this idea, which other scholars are writing about it as well, about kind of the party's role in this. It's not just a personal choice. Julia Zari and William Adler have some wonderful research on this. I'd point to that the party can influence the choice. In this case, we clearly see that working out, that McCain got this pushback, like, this guy's not conservative enough. Lieberman, just for one thing, not the only thing, but he's pro-choice on abortion. How would that fly with the Republican Party? McCain finally accepts this just days before he really has to make the choice of a running mate. And so what he ends up with is, rather than the extensive, you know, full-on vetting that usually takes place and is going on right now for Joe Biden, basically in 72 hours, his team decides on Sarah Palin. They pass up what was considered a boring choice, the Minnesota governor, Tim Pawlenty, because it wouldn't shake up the race enough. This was the chance for a game changer, so they said. And so they went for someone bold with Sarah Palin, assuming, based on limited evidence, including inviting her to the ranch. McCain had never really interacted with her before, met her once at a dinner, I think. But they have this, you know, significant interview in Arizona. The clock's ticking, so he kind of knows he has to make this choice. Anyway, they invite her to, I think, reassure themselves that she's as good as she seems to be on TV, which she was. And they end up realizing, as the campaign goes on, you know, basically, I'm paraphrasing from something quoted in the book. Essentially, their take was, you know, we thought she would just kind of know as much as any governor who's ready for a national campaign would know. We didn't realize her limitations, at least to go to the national level. I think by a lot of accounts, she was actually pretty effective as a governor of Alaska, but put on a national stage, she didn't seem as comfortable in that role. Which, by the way, if I could throw this in, you know, applying this to 2020, I think that goes to the value of having someone who has not just national exposure, but someone who's actually auditioned for the role of the presidency. I think it goes a long way to have just run for president. So, for instance, Val Demings, who gets a lot of attention as potential running mate for Joe Biden, she was one of the folks trying the impeachment case in the Senate against Donald Trump. She had a lot of national exposure, but you look at the polls, most people don't know who she is. They don't have an opinion. I think it's like 60% don't have an opinion of her. She's not well known. Someone like Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, they're much better known. I think it's like 20 to 25% don't have an opinion of them, which might still surprise some people. But they have run for the presidency. They've been on that stage auditioning for the presidency. And even if they weren't successful in it, I think it's a lot easier to convince voters right away for Joe Biden if you were to pick someone like that, or I don't know, someone else who might be comfortable, whoever. Might be easier to convince them that this is someone who is ready to be president. And by the way, the campaign can have reassurance from actually having seen them in action on the national stage. You can't just assume someone, even if they're very capable in other positions, is ready for that particular role.
We're talking with Christopher J. Devine, assistant professor of political science at the University of Dayton and co-author of the new book, Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. I think it's appropriate that we do start to wrap this up with a quick conversation about Joe Biden's selection process. You named several women who are being considered, apparently, according to reports. And certainly Biden has made it clear that he is going to select a woman as his running mate. And I know we established at the beginning of our conversation, Christopher, that what sets your book apart is that it's not from the punditry class. It's not speculative. But I guess now I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit. I mean, based on the research that you've conducted and the evidence that you've uncovered, if you were to advise former Vice President Joe Biden as he selects this, what would be your advice? Not necessarily to endorse a particular candidate, but the considerations that he should prioritize.
Yeah, I appreciate the way you asked the question. I think that's on target. You know, this would be usually the point in an interview where someone say, well, I have the perfect pick. OK, it's this person. Right. And I reveal the one who's going to win the election for Joe Biden or is going to maximize his impact. That's not my position. You know, hey, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But my take on things is there are a range of people who could do an equally fine job in the electoral role, the vice presidential candidate. OK. I think what Joe Biden should do is look at the, you know, kind of some smallish pool of potential running mates who would do a really good job, would be a really effective partner for him in the White House. and kind of just, you know, sense of if they meet the threshold, are they immediately going to seem qualified to voters? Maybe do they affect his kind of ideological strategy if he wants to paint himself more left or center? We do find there's actually some effect ideologically for the running mates in shaping perception of the presidential candidate. So, you know, that might govern whether he chooses, let's say, Elizabeth Warren, if he wants to appear more to the left, if he wants to appear more in the center, you know, he has some range of other choices. I tend to think, to give you a more direct answer, I tend to think Kamala Harris is, I wouldn't say the best pick, but she's just a very sensible pick. She makes a lot of sense to me for Biden in terms of what his goals may be. And I say that in part because not only has she been embedded on the national stage, she has a good range of experience. She's clearly qualified. Okay. For one thing, she's a good bit younger, you know, that fits what he needs as well, but also she's hard to pin down ideologically. It's hard to say firmly whether Kamala Harris is well to the left of the party or in the center. In fact, I think if you ask folks on both sides of the party, they'll say, hey, she's not, you know, she's not part of our camp. They might disown her, but that could be actually a good thing because picking, let's say, Elizabeth Warren clearly is a loss for moderates in the party. It's a win for progressives, right? You pick a moderate, it's a loss for progressives, kind of like when Hillary Clinton picked Tim Kaine in 2016. Hard to mistake that. You pick someone who's harder to pin down. Harris is one. I'm sure you could think of others. I think that allows both factions to feel like they didn't exactly lose, even if they didn't exactly win. And where the Democratic Party is right now for figuring itself out ideologically, I think that's not a bad place to be.
Okay. In our last minute together, Christopher, I'm going to ask you to speculate one more time, just based on the current political climate, how that might impact the type of research that you've conducted. Because even as all of these election cycles move forward into the future, there are different accesses that become available to media consumption. And certainly now we live in a very strange period on how we consume news and the types of news that can be available to us, and often misleading, often quite polarizing. But we see a polarization in this country that's more than just left versus right. It's like far left versus center left, far right versus center right. We have this growing chorus of voices that are traditional Republicans, now most recently John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, coming out in support of Democratic nominee Joe Biden. But you also have members of the far left who may have supported Bernie Sanders, may have supported further left policies, who do not view Biden favorably and are watching very closely who he might pick. What type of evidence do you think might emerge from the autopsy on this election year as it relates to the further ideological divide that's happening even within the already existing ideological divide?
Yeah, I think it'd be fascinating to see what the effect of this particular choice is, especially as, you know, Michael, you're referring to the increasing kind of partisan polarization. I think that does make it harder to move people. It makes the shift between, let's say, going from George W. Bush to Al Gore in 2000, that kind of the ground you have to cover was a good bit less than going between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in 2020. So I do think it's going to be harder to move people. Based on especially something as, not the primary issue in the race being the choice of a running mate. So I'm skeptical of how much people can be moved. But, you know, to that polarization, kind of different ideological identities, I think it will be really telling who Joe Biden picks as his running mate in terms of ideology. While I mostly downplayed the electoral effects, going back to the idea of shaping perceptions of the presidential candidate, this does influence perceptions of ideology. We show this in 2008 that basically people who thought that Sarah Palin was very conservative were much more likely to think that John McCain was very conservative, as opposed to folks who thought that Sarah Palin was moderate. So for Joe Biden, he needs to make a choice. Is he more concerned about his left flank, or is he more concerned about going after, say, the John Kasichs of the world, or maybe centrist Democrats? The choice he makes could influence how effectively he's able to go after one of those versus the other. And I think going after both at the same time would be awfully hard. So he probably does have to make a choice.
Christopher J. Devine is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Dayton, and along with Kyle C. Kopko, the co-author of Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. It's now available. Christopher, thank you so much for the time you gave us today. Very great conversation. Appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.